Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. I am now in Psalms chapter 63. We will call this psalm, My Soul Thirsts for You. Now, the heading of the psalm is a psalm of David when he was in the desert of Judah. So we are going to assume this psalm was written by David. When was he in the desert of Judah? Well, here's some options. The NIV Study Bible and Jamison Fawcett and Brown suggest this is referring to the time when David fled Absalom, when he went across the Jordan River there to Mahanaim, right near Succoth on the east side of the Jordan River. I don't know if that was desert or not, though I assume it was. I don't know why the NIV Study Bible and Jamison Fawcett and Brown suggest that this is when it was, because it seems to me it could have been just as easily the time that David was fleeing from Saul at the first part of his reign as opposed to the last part of his reign when he fled from Absalom. But at any rate, it doesn't make any difference as far as the interpretation of the psalm. The point is, in deserts, there ain't no water. There's no sustenance. So we need God. David needed God. We read in verse 1, and also in verses 2 through 5, David says this. He's praying to God. He says, God, you are my God. I eagerly seek you. I thirst for you. My body faints for you in a land that is dry, desolate, and without water. So I gaze on you in the sanctuary to see your strength and your glory. My lips will glorify you because your faithful love is better than life. So I will praise you as long as I live. At your name I will lift up my hands. You satisfy me as with rich food. My mouth will praise you with joyful lips. Now the setting of the psalm is a desert. He says, my body faints in a land that is dry, desolate, and without water. Here's what BiblePlaces.com says about the desert of Judah, which is that desert right around Jerusalem, heading down to the Dead Sea and around Jerusalem going south as you're in the tribe of Judah. This is what BiblePlaces.com says about that desert. Quote, because of its lack of water and good routes, the Judean wilderness has been mostly uninhabited throughout history. Consequently, it was an ideal place for those seeking refuge from enemies or retreat from the world. Well, that's where David was. He was seeking refuge from his enemies, whether it was Saul or Absalom. In verse 2, David says, so I gaze on you in the sanctuary. Now, David could have just said, I gaze on you, God, because you're everywhere, including the desert. But he particularly mentions the sanctuary. I gaze on you in the sanctuary. That would be the tabernacle. So even though God is omnipresent, he was especially present in the sanctuary. Now, this is a good application point, a good antidote for those who don't go to church. And they say, well, God is everywhere. I can worship God in my living room as I watch the baseball game. I can worship God in my garden as I work to plant tomatoes. No, there's a special place for God. It's in the sanctuary. And of course, the New Testament sanctuary is the Church of Christ. I mention this because there are so many Christians today who don't go to church. This is totally foolish. It is totally unscriptural, but people do it all the time. And one reason is because churches are so lousy in America today. I realize we're in need of a reformation, a new reformation. I realize that, but that's no excuse not to go to church. You look and you look and you pray and you pray. And if that's you still can't find one, then start one. Find somebody who will start one for you if you're not capable of starting one. It's not easy. I realize that, but you know, it's the same thing I would tell young Chinese Christian women in China where the church is 80% women and they can't find husbands. I said, well, all you need is one, and your God's a big God, so start praying. And I've seen lots of Chinese young Christian women find husbands. They might not have been Chinese Christians, but they were Christians, and they got married, hopefully, happily ever after. It's the same thing. You can't find a church, keep praying, because you need one. Don't just give up and say, I'm just not going to go to church. All right, so David says he gazes on God in the sanctuary in order to see God's strength and to see God's glory. Now, how did David see God's strength and God's glory? Two options. One, he could have seen God's strength and God's glory in the Ark of the Covenant, over which God's power and glory dwelt. The Shekinah glory, of course, filled the Holy of Holies a lot of times, and it probably came through the tent and hovered over the tent as well. Well, if this is what David meant, he must have seen the ark at a different time than when he was in the desert, because David was never with the ark in the wilderness. Here's another option as to how David saw God. The Ellicott commentary says that God was seen by David in a spiritual vision. Ellicott says, quote, the Hebrew word is that generally used of prophetic vision. In other words, seeing God is a prophetic seeing of God according to the Hebrew. I don't know Hebrew. I don't know whether Ellicott is right, but he thinks he is. So I mentioned that. So David would be in the sanctuary when he had this vision of God, because he says in verse 2, I gaze on you in the sanctuary. So if he was doing that, then his seeing God must not have been in the desert, because the sanctuary was never with David. The tabernacle was never with David when David was in the wilderness. So here's what Joseph Benson, the commentator, says about that. Quote, he, that's David, David longs to be brought out of this wilderness, not that he might see his friends again and be restored to the pleasures and gaieties of the court, but that he might have access to the sanctuary, not to see the priest there and the ceremonies of the worship, but to see the power and glory that is the glorious power or powerful glory of God. So what Benson is saying is that David is longing to see God after he gets out of the wilderness, or maybe before he got out of the wilderness. Homer Christian Study Bible translates the verb in the infinitive, which has no time on it. I gaze on you in the sanctuary to see. Well, that could have been in the past before he ended up in the desert, or it could be after he gets out of the desert. Now in verse 2, David says he wants to see God's glory in the sanctuary. That glory could either be the Shekinah glory, the smoky cloud that represented God's presence in those days, at least in the days of the Exodus. I guess the Shekinah glory was still around when the ark ended up, when the tabernacle ended up in Hebron, after it wandered through the land of Israel during the times of Joshua. But David could just be saying he wants to see God's glory in general, not specifically the Shekinah glory. Verse 3, David says, my lips will glorify you because your faithful love is better than life. That's obvious what that means. Verse 4, so I will praise you as long as I live. At your name I will lift up my hands. In other words, as soon as I hear the name of God, I'm going to lift up my hands. Now, what does lift up hands mean? Well, there's three options for that. It could be that David wanted to lift his hands up in prayer. It could be that David wanted to lift up his hands in blessing and praise, which of course is similar. Generally, when you pray, you also praise God and bless God. It could be that David wants to take an oath by lifting up his hands, because that's how you took an oath, kind of like we do in our courtrooms today. And so that would mean he would be lifting up his hands to swear fealty to his Lord. I don't think that's what it means. I think it's prayer and blessing and praise. Soon as he hears God's name, at your name, I'm going to do this, David says. Verse 5, you satisfy me as with rich food. My mouth will praise you with joyful lips. Now, David doesn't mention getting his thirst satisfied in these first five verses. He does mention, though, that he gets food. I think that the satisfaction of his thirst is understood. And then he specifically states he's satisfied with rich food. The NIV says the richest of foods. We're talking about caviar, lobster, beef burgundy, sirloin steaks, that kind of thing. The best. God loves to bless his children. Now, that doesn't mean that, of course, that we'd never suffer, that we don't have temptations or trials. David had plenty of trials, but he said he was satisfied. Now, of course, he's not talking about literally rich food. He says, you satisfy me as with rich food. It's a metaphor. He's satisfied spiritually, and of course, sometimes maybe God gave him rich food too. I don't mean to deny that, but that's not the main point. The main point is that God satisfies the thirsty believer. And these people who have dead spiritual lives, well, God's never there. I don't know why God let this happen to me. Do they really thirst for God? Have they really been seeking God? Have they been trying to build a relationship with him? No, they haven't. We go down to Psalms 63, verses 6 through 8. David continues praying to God. When I remember you on my bed, David says, I meditate on you in the night watches, for you have been my help, and in the shadow of your wings I sing for joy. My soul clings to you. Your right hand upholds me. So David's lying on his bed. He's sleeping. He's meditating on God. He's thinking about God. He's cogitating on God in the night watches. The night is divided differently by the Jews and the Romans, incidentally, because we see this phrase in the New Testament too, and those were generally the Roman watches. Smith's Bible Dictionary tells us the time of these watches. The Jews had three watches, from sunset to 10 o'clock at night. From 10 o'clock at night to 2 a.m. in the morning is the second watch. The Jews had three watches. The first watch was from sunset to 10 o'clock at night. The second watch was from 10 o'clock at night to 2 o'clock in the morning. And the third watch was from 2 o'clock in the morning to sunrise. The Romans had four watches, from sunrise to 9 o'clock at night, from 9 o'clock to midnight, from midnight to 3 o'clock, from 3 o'clock to 6 o'clock in the morning. That has relevance when you're trying to reconcile some time statements in the four Gospels. It's a little bit of a rabbit trail, but it's worth mentioning. But the point of our psalm here is that David not only thirsts for God in the daytime, at night he's meditating upon God. He's meditating upon God day and night. Why? Verse 7:4, because you have been my help, and in the shadow of your wings I sing for joy. God is always helping David because David is constantly being beset by enemies. David is in the shadow of God's wings. What's the metaphor there? A bird covers her young while they're in the nest. When a storm comes, the NIV Study Bible says. Could be referring, as Adam Clark says, to a hen hiding her head under her own wings when a storm comes. Again, protection from the storms of life, or it could be protection from the merciless sun, the heat that's in those wilderness areas. Here's some other scriptures expressing the same point. Both of these psalms were written by David. Psalm 17:8, keep me as the apple of the eye, hide me in the shadow of your wings. Psalms 57:1, be gracious to me, O God, be gracious to me, for my soul takes refuge in you, and in the shadow of your wings I will take refuge until destruction passes by. So the shadow of God's wings is a metaphor that David liked to use. In verse 8, David says, my soul clings to you. That's the NASB translation. The KJV says, my soul followeth hard after. I like that. My soul followeth hard after you. Your right hand upholds me. Why right hand is opposed to the left hand? Because the right hand is the hand of power, because most people are right-handed and they are stronger with that hand. So that is an anthropomorphic symbol for the strength of God. God's power is associated with God's love. He not only wants to help his children out because he loves them, but he also has the power to do it. We go now to verses 9 through 11 in Psalm 63. But those who seek my life to destroy it will go into the depths of the earth. David continues. He's not praying to God anymore. He's speaking in the third person to a general audience, whoever is listening to his psalm or reading it as we are. But those who seek my life to destroy it will go into the depths of the earth. They will be delivered over to the power of the sword. They will be a prey for foxes. But the king will rejoice in God. Everyone who swears by him will glory, for the mouths of those who speak lies will be stopped. Now in verse 9, David says his pursuers will go into the depths of the earth. Some options as to what that might mean. It could just mean that David's pursuers will go into the grave, the depths of the earth. So this is suggested by Clark and Jameson, Fawcett and Brown, but there's a problem with that because the righteous go into the depths of the earth too, so why is it any worse for the unrighteous to go into the depths of the earth? Well, the answer to that is David is saying that he wants the wicked to go to a premature grave in the depths of the earth. In other words, they will go into the depths of the earth at the time they are seeking my life to destroy it, not at the end of a long and happy life. Now, it could mean that David is saying, I pray that those who seek my life to destroy it will go into hell, into the depths of the earth, which would be a symbol of hell. Well, that's what John Gill says. Of course, they didn't really have hell back then. They had Hades. So it's either physically into the grave or into Sheol, Greek Hades, the shadowy world of the dead. I think it's just as easy to say here, David wants his pursuers to be killed and to leave him alone. They will be delivered over to the power of the sword. They will be killed. They will be a prey for foxes, the NASB says. Most translations have jackals because that's a better translation. First of all, how can a tiny fox chase the wicked? Well, John Gill says that foxes hunt after dead carcasses. So it will be foxes chasing the dead after they are killed. They will be a prey for foxes after they are killed. The context of verse 10 says that because the first part of verse 10 says that the enemies of David will be delivered over to the power of the sword. They'll be dead, and then there will be a prey for foxes. So that will explain how a fox will be going after a big human being. But a better way to explain it is to translate it as jackals. Now the NIV, the Holman Christian Study Bible, translate it as jackals. Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown say that the word literally means jackals. Here's what Clark says about jackals. The jackal is a very ravenous beast and fond of human flesh. It devours dead bodies, steals infants out of the lap of their mothers, devours alive the sick who are left by the side of the Ganges, and even in the streets of Calcutta has been known to eat persons who were in a state of intoxication. So the moral there is, don't get drunk when there are jackals around. So I like that translation better. The enemies of David will be a prey for jackals. Delete them up. Verse 11, but the king will rejoice in God. That would be David rejoicing in God because he's the king. Everyone who swears by him will glory. Now we have a problem. Everyone who swears by him, is that swearing by David? Everyone who swears by David will glory, will boast. Or everyone who swears by God will boast. Well, there's a pretty much 50% split of opinion on that. The NASB has him capitalized, so that makes it refer to God. Everyone who swears by capital H him, God, will boast. But as you know, the Hebrew does not have capital letters. You cannot capitalize a Hebrew character any more than you can capitalize a Chinese character. So which is it? Well, Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown says that it's those who swear by David the king will boast. Sounds a little pretentious, but that's what Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown say it is, and Clark says it's maybe that. Here's what Clark says. It was customary to swear by the life of the king. The Egyptians swore by the life of Pharaoh, and Joseph conforms to this custom, as may be seen in the book of Genesis. And Clark gives a lot of scriptures, so let's look at these scriptures to show people swearing by the life of either a king or an important person. Genesis 42:15. This is how you will be tested. As surely as Pharaoh lives, you will not leave this place until your youngest brother comes here. That's referring to Joseph's brothers. This is how you brothers will be tested. As surely as Pharaoh lives. So that's an oath taken on the life of Pharaoh. Genesis 42:16, the next verse. Send one from among you to get your brother. The rest of you will be imprisoned so that your words can be tested to see if they are true. If they are not, then as surely as Pharaoh lives. That's again, that's an oath. Whenever you see as surely as something, that's an oath. Swearing on the king's life. 1 Samuel 1:26. This is Hannah speaking. Please, my lord, she said, as sure as you live, my lord. It's taking an oath on Eli's head. I am the woman who stood here beside you praying to the Lord. 1 Samuel 17:55. When Saul had seen David going out to confront the Philistine, he asked Abner, the commander of the army, whose son is this youth, Abner? My king, as surely as you live, I don't know. So Abner is swearing on the life of Saul. 2 Samuel 15:21. But Ittai, this is Ittai the Gittite, he was someone in Jerusalem during the time of Absalom's rebellion, and he, instead of staying in Jerusalem, wanted to come out of Jerusalem with David and be loyal to David. But Ittai answered the king, King David, and said, as the Lord lives. Well, that's swearing by God. But then he also swears by David. He says, and as my lord the king lives. Surely wherever my lord the king may be, whether for death or for life, there also your servant will be. As my lord the king lives. Now here are some translations that have a lowercase h signifying that David is talking about swearing an oath by the king himself. If people did that, they would be able to boast. The KJV, the ASV, the Bible in Basic English, and the Darby translation, they all have a lowercase h. Now, this is assuming that that particular translation's orthography normally capitalizes him when it's God that's being referred to by the pronoun. And I didn't go back and check that. But here are some translations which say the swearing is by God. And if you swear by God, then you'll be able to boast. The NASB capitalizes him, as I've said. The NIV says, those who swear by God's name will be able to boast. God's word says those who swear by God will be able to boast. The New American Bible says those who swear by the Lord will be able to boast. So that's about 50-50. I report, you decide. I will say that I tend to think it's those who swear by God will glory because David is giving praise to God in the psalm. Why would he talk about people swearing by the king? I guess he could be saying God preserves me so well that you'll be able to swear by me and be happy about it. Boast about it. I swore by David, and look, he's still alive. All right, so we'll leave that alone, 50-50. Verse 11 concludes, for the mouths of those who speak lies will be stopped once again. A positive end of a psalm, as David always does, and we are now finished with Psalms 63 and are now ready to go to Psalm 64 in our next audio, which we will entitle, Hide Me from the Wicked. I hope you stay tuned for that audio, and I hope you enjoyed this one.